The 1995 Sunstone Symposium presents session number 360, When Does a Congregation Become a Community? A panel featuring John Lear, Kathleen Flake, and Judy Dushku.
And the name of it is, When Does a Congregation Become a Community? Pretty interesting topic. And our panelists today will first be Judy Dushku, and she is an associate professor of political science and teaches women's studies at Suffolk University in Boston. And she will be attending the United Nations Women's Conference pretty soon, so that's a pretty interesting thing. And she's one of the founders of Exponent 2. And she said about her experience in wards, she was a single mom for a long time. She's on her second marriage. And so she was a single mother in different wards and had that kind of experience. She enjoys traveling and is a lifetime member of the church and has many different experiences and exposure to many different kinds of congregations. And then our second panelist is John Lear, and he is the founding member of the B.H. Roberts Society. And then last, we'll be hearing from Kathleen Flake. She's a practicing attorney in Washington, D.C., and she got a master's in liturgical studies from the Catholic University, and she served a mission to Japan, and has served in many various callings, two of them being a temple preparation teacher and a teacher for the investigators class. And she's currently living in an inner city branch, and she's been living and going to that branch since 1987. And so we will start off with Judy and go from there.
I've had a casual with these many kinds of trainings that they do in corporations and schools and all those places now where they want to rather quickly bring a group together and do what they call community building. And I'm sure you're familiar with those. How many of you have done one of those kinds of things? Just yes, so you're familiar with that. And they're so common now that I think there'll come a time when very few people are able to even escape them, and there's some increasing cynicism about them, but they certainly have their use, and I think a lot of people have come to appreciate and almost expect at the beginning of some corporate training some kind of activity where people are put together and they're introduced to one another and then expected to build a community. And as I was thinking about this topic and those community building exercises, I was trying to sort of hone in on what I perceived to be the stated and common goals of those community-building activities. I know my kids have gone to Outward Bound, and they do them. I've heard, you know, Wellspring, the training that came out of Salt Lake and spread through, at least through the Eastern Church, too, and that made us all okay for a while. Then we all disintegrated into our lives again. Anyway, the goals of those programs are usually quite clearly stated to build a sense of necessary interdependence between the different people, the participants in the group. As a part of that interdependence, a secondary goal is to build a sense of trust between the people that are there. Thirdly, to make people feel comfortable in revealing each or every one of their, not everyone, but each person in the group to reveal their vulnerability so that they will encourage others to come forward and help them where they're vulnerable and where their needs are shown. And then I think the overriding goal of these community building activities is to make the clear message for people to internalize that the success of the entire group depends on the success of each person in the group. And as you, many of you raised your hand, I don't know what your experiences are, but from what I've heard and what my own experiences are, I've done everything from cross a log, to climb over a wall where some people nimbly climb over the wall and others have a struggle, but the rule is the group is not successful until everybody's over the wall. And so if the nimble people get over first, then they have to come back and help the less nimble. And And we struggle and we work until everybody's over the wall or everybody that's been lost is found and all these things. So I was thinking about this in terms of this notion of community building in wards, and I was thinking about how simple, how very, very simple these goals are and how true they are for organizations and how they have been true for organizations over many, many years in terms of being able to judge a group experience as a success. I mean, one of the things that makes for a successful and beautiful group experience is that these four things have been accomplished. And although they haven't been so bluntly stated in the past, they've happened sort of accidentally or as a result of certain fortuitous leadership, these kinds of things, the one for all for one kind of experience has been a common denominator. So I started thinking about my ward, and I had said to Elbert a few years ago when he met me in the parking lot of a Sunstone Symposium in Boston, he said, "How are you?" And I said, "I'm in an Enoch-type ward right now." And so that's why I'm on this panel, is he wanted to know, how did that come into being? Where did that ward come from? How was it accomplished? He's about a year late in terms of that ward being the way it was. The ward is fine now, and I know I'm on tape, and so I want to be very careful. We have a nice ward that's functioning well, but we have a new bishop in the last year and a half, and in fact, it's my feeling, and I think others share it, that we have lost a certain something that was the essence of this Enoch-like experience that many of us felt for about the period between 1991 and 1994. And so I was trying to look back and figure out how that experience occurred. And one of the problems I've had with figuring it out is that the former bishop and the Relief Society president absolutely refused that they had a goal and an intention to create this group experience. They insist that it was everybody's contribution, that it just happened because everybody loved one another spontaneously. And I realize that each of them has a feeling that it was a spiritual thing, and they don't want to analyze it too carefully, and especially in corporate terms. They also don't want to take credit for too much of it. They want to share that credit, and I appreciate that. I appreciate their goodness in not wanting to be too blunt. But someday I'm going to pin them against the wall and I'm going to make them confess to some very specific goals about how these things were accomplished. But what I have to share with you are just some of the stories of some of the things that happened under their leadership. And how much, where are you? Just let me know because I talk a lot. Okay, one of the first things that happened, and the bishop was Gary Crittenden and the Relief Society president was Susan Porter. By the way, Susan Porter's husband, Bruce, has just been made area representative or something of East Europe. In our ward, it went through the ward so many people said that it was remarkable. Oh, they wanted Susan there, and since the church can't call Susan to be the area rep, they had to call Bruce so that Susan could be the area rep. Now that is actually not because there's anything lacking in Bruce. Bruce is a wonderful, remarkable, fine person. But Susan was such a fine Relief Society president that our ward shares that feeling about her. But anyway, some of the things that happened immediately after Gary was called to be our bishop. One of the things that happened was there'd been a woman investigating the church for about 7 years. She'd come every Sunday, and she'd been told that she would not be baptized until she had the permission and support of her husband. And apparently that had not happened because for 7 years she came unbaptized. And within 3 weeks of Gary's being called to be bishop, this woman was baptized into the church, into our ward. And of course there was a big question, how did this happen? Did her husband suddenly just offer his permission? And the word was, and it's been sort of mythologized, so I don't know exactly what happened, but the word was that Gary's approach was simply to say, you know, rather than seek out his explicit permission and his articulated support, why don't we go on what you want and then ask if he is going to stand in the way of that? And then, according to legend, he said to her something to the effect that if you want this badly, you are responsible for your own salvation, and you get to make the decision about whether you will be baptized or not. And within 2 weeks, she was baptized, and she's been a member, very active member ever since. And there's a lot that I could say about her family, but it's her story, and I feel like I don't have permission to tell that. But it was a very interesting lesson, and the fact that it kind of spread through the ward almost as a symbolic gesture in terms of what Gary's bishopricking might be like, I think is important, because from the very beginning then, it seemed to a lot of us that there was a kind of signal that he had a lot of respect for individuals' right to make decisions for themselves, and that he respected people's agency and and right to personal revelation. And it was different from the previous two bishops. The second thing that happened, and I will camouflage this woman's name because she would die if I spoke of her publicly, but about a month after Gary was bishop, I was sitting on the back row of the chapel, and this woman, whom I will call Kay, who's a very meme mother of many, non-dissenting, loyal, you know, whatever, I'll go where you want me to go, dear Lord, kind of woman. And she scooted into the ward, and the music was playing, and she said, I have an interesting story to tell you. And she said, I was in priesthood executive meeting last week and today, and she said, I know you'll appreciate this. I was asked my opinion by a man, in this case, the bishop. And not only was I asked, but then I was expected to respond, and then he listened. And I realized that time, in 9 years, that a Mormon man has asked my opinion and listened to my response. And I said, well, tell me more about how it happened. And she got all choked up, and she said, it was so profound. Last week, we were talking about ward goals, and she was an auxiliary president. And she said, Gary said to me, I'll call her Kay, do you think that family preparedness and food storage should be of high priority in our ward goals this year? And she said, typical of me, I said, oh, I don't care. Whatever everybody else says, I'll go along. And he said, no, that's not good enough. You've been in the ward a long time. You know everyone. You're sensitive to people's family needs and family goals. We want to hear from you. And she said, he was so concerned with my opinion that when I couldn't come up with an opinion, he said, we will adjourn the meeting. We want to hear from Kay, and we'll reconvene next week. And Kay, we want you to tell us what you think the goals of our ward should be. She said, this has been one of the most unbelievable weeks of my life. She said, I have thought about it. I have felt inspired. I have felt important in a ward that I've been in for most of my adult life. And when I spoke my piece today, people listened, and I felt special, and I felt like I had a role to play. And she said, I thought you'd be interested, knowing who I am and my feminist leanings. And so, of course, I was, and we cried a little together. And we've only talked about it once since, and, you know, she's sort of in her role in the ward. But we've shared that experience, and it did allow us to wink at each other from time to time during the next, 2 years as we continued in this process. There were other things that happened. There was a woman in the ward who was an incest survivor and had been very public about her memories in the two or three previous years. I'm looking around to see if there are any people in my ward. She really went through a very bad time where she acted in ways that anybody would be able to, perhaps unkindly but quite correctly, identify as being crazy. I mean, she would run out of the chapel, and when offended by a talk, you know, she would throw her hymn book, you know, during a meeting down the aisle, and once ran out of the chapel and threw her shoes at the window, and I mean, would be very, very angry. And some people were very distressed by this. And again, this dear bishop became her friend. And soon she was in therapy, which the ward was paying for out of welfare funds. And he never spoke of her as though she were disabled or troubled, but simply as someone who had a different experience that we could all learn from. And by the end of his period of being a bishop, they were not only good friends, but she had achieved a level of calm and peace that is certainly, it's able to go out the window from time to time, but it's still so much greater than it ever was before. And it was an entirely different experience having her in the ward at the end of that than when he had become bishop and when Susan became Relief Society president. Also, Susan was her visiting teaching companion, and they were my visiting teachers. And the way Susan also treated her was as though she were honored to have Evelyn as her teacher, because Evelyn had life experiences which the rest of us needed to understand. The other thing that was very bluntly approached was that even though we live in a very affluent ward, there are different factions in our ward. There are poorer people, there are people of different ethnic groups, and although it's not a terribly diverse ward, one of the things that Susan and Gary both did was to make it absolutely their goal that every auxiliary leadership group had people from every different group so that there was no sense that the mainstreamers, the people who'd always run the ward, were always doing it. It's very balanced, and the ward was owned by more people. I could tell a whole bunch more stories. I loved that experience. It was very sweet. Many people bore their testimony to the fact that it was a very beautiful and unique experience. And then Gary became counselor in the state presidency, and Susan moved to Provo, and our ward is a little different. So in trying to summarize what I think happened during that time, I've been groping, and I think that if I could think of one thing that built this sense of unbelievable interdependence and a sense of the success of all depends on the success of each one, was that the way that people spoke to each other changed, because there was an example set by the leadership, the bishop and actually the two members of the bishopric who were naturally inclined to that, but they followed enthusiastically, and also the Relief Society presidency as the six leaders of the ward really changed the way they talked about one another and in the ward. And there was a real shift in the sense that the ward belonged to everyone. And one of my last thought is that just a few weeks ago, Gary spoke in a meeting, and Evelyn was crying. We were sitting together. It was a stake meeting. And she said, "I love this man. I'll love him always." He said that ever since he was bishop in the ward, whenever he gives a talk, before he stands and gives his talk, he said, "I say to myself, if Evelyn were in this room, what would she want me to say? And how can I say what I have to say without offending her?" And to me, what that says is that the leadership adopted the perspective of those who had been less powerful and taught themselves to respond in ways that were not their natural perspective. And as there have been many, many talks on community building, this Sunstone Symposium, and I know Janice Allred yesterday spoke about reversing roles and reversing perspectives, and I think that was one of the things that was accomplished that allowed our ward to feel that we were all in this together and that we were all moving toward a kind of spiritual success that could not be accomplished unless every single person felt it equally and enthusiastically and genuinely. I feel like I haven't quite said it all, but it was a wonderful experience, and I hope that at least you can understand the essence of what I'm trying to say. It was something that all of us felt, and I miss it tremendously, and it's the kind of thing that I certainly would work hard to accomplish were I in a position to accomplish that, and at least I'm willing to support it whenever I can.
Well, I can tell based on those comments that this is going to be a study perhaps in contrasting communities, if not in masculine and feminine perspectives, certainly in different life experiences. My comments are probably as what I would characterize as probably more macro. Now, I don't know whether that's a male approach to issues of community, as we have seen some and heard some wonderful vignettes about the very specific. I'm not really sure why I got asked to participate in this particular panel. I don't know that I have any particular expertise. I'm an attorney, and that should eliminate me immediately, because we spend most of our lives destroying community as opposed to building them. I don't know that any of my experiences have any particular value or relevance, but I'm always happy to offer my opinion. So in that regard, I will. Maybe a little bit of background, which I didn't have time to give. I live in a ward that I really enjoy and have for the last 10 or so years. And as a consequence, whenever in position of authority, attempt to extend my vision of what community is, and when others are in authority, attempt to follow theirs. And so far, it's proven to be a relatively satisfying experience. But let me maybe make some observations quickly about community. My first questions about community came as I attempted to slog my way through Augustine's City of God. I didn't make it, for any of those of you that were concerned about that or have ever tried. But what was planted in my head was the question of, if God were here, exactly what kind of community would he really be tempting to create? What would it look like? What does the political economy of God, what does a local organization look like if we were really living in that kind of an organization? A second observation I want to make, and for those of you that may have done much better in literature than I did, you can probably give me this reference, because what I remember is the line and not even the author or the context. I think it came from either Keats or Yeats. But the line in question that I have great memory of is the ending line, and it says, "And the center will not hold." And I'll find the reference someplace. I couldn't as I looked for it. I believe that is what is at essence in the issue of community. If we fail in our abilities to build communities at all levels, neighborhood communities, regional communities, national communities, the center will fail and it will not hold, and we will all suffer the consequences. I grew up as a child of the 60s and probably helped instigate some of the turmoil, at least on a relative basis, that existed at that time. And since then, however, I have watched society splinter and polarize in ways that I could never have imagined. And as a consequence, I believe we end up losing our sense of community. As what the last 30 years have brought us, I think, is absolutely a fixation with the individual over any other element of our culture. And the greatest casualty of that fixation is, in fact, our community. As a consequence, I become increasingly aware of the need to create communities, particularly in light of a culture that has almost completely lost focus on the needs of the individual as paramount in concern. What we now need are individuals who are concerned about community. The question of this panel is why some wards make us feel good while others just don't seem to adhere in the same way, and what are my opinions in that regard? I have some quick observations that I'd like to make. First, let me start by saying that I believe the question of community, though it is often not asked in the church in very straightforward terms, is absolutely a central question and is at the root of the very foundation of our religious tradition. If one steps back and takes a look at the things that the prophet Joseph was doing, all of them direct themselves to his effort to at least ask questions about, and then once those questions were asked, to establish a new set of relationships or community. He asked basic questions and attempted, with God's help, to redefine the fundamental nature of almost every aspect of human relationships or community, including our relationship with God, our economic relationships, our church and institutional liturgy and relationships, our relationships to the cosmos and the environment, and our sexual relationships. To me, Joseph was an anarchist, and what he was basically saying, if you look back over all of the things that he did, was that the communities and the institutions that we have around us are not working. We need to redefine those communities in a way that will help us grow, truly obtain joy as individuals. Clearly, Joseph saw the need for fundamental change. The radical nature of the suggestions he made ultimately cost him his life. But what he was dedicated to was building a new community where all of us as human beings could grow and thrive. Maybe then, in looking at the communities we have, I'm going to take it from a little bit different direction, and I'm going to make a couple of observations about what destroys them, rather than perhaps looking at what builds them, which I'm sure others have addressed themselves to. I believe that the most pervasive enemy of community that we have today is our economy. It is not necessarily our economic system per se, though that's a lot of it, but rather it is the way we choose to practice it. Our economy pulverizes family, both extended and nuclear. It pulls us apart so that as economic individuals we are separated and specialized. It has no regard for roots and traditions, values, but rather demands we serve it and it alone on its terms and conditions. And ironically, when we do, even the rewards we get separate us into gated communities and ghettos. We no longer work together in common economic activities to build a single common community, but rather compete in a multiplicity of activities to build our own individual kingdoms. I think we have a wonderful example. Wonderful may be not exactly the right word, but we have an explicit example of the divergence between the kinds of communities we built here 150 years ago and the kinds of communities we are building now. I was talking to a friend about a trip he took down through Escalante, Utah, and he was struck by the fact that as he went down the old main street, here were these wonderful old houses laid out in community with one another, with irrigation ditches sharing roads and waters and fruit trees and orchards, which was the community of 100 or 150 years ago. The new community of Escalante was built up on the hill with private roads, with big houses in isolation from one another. That, I believe, is the product of the economy that we have chosen to adopt. We are economic people at root. When we tried the United Order, we tried an effort to integrate our economic, our political, our social, and our religious lives. When we failed at the United Order, which we did, when we rejoined the American political tradition, we adopted an economic system that, while it provides great wealth and great prosperity, also has, as one of its co-conspirators, if you will, an element that drives us apart and is not communitarian in its nature. We have a fundamental problem and always will until we recognize that. A second or third problem, depending on where we are in all of this, facing our community, I believe, and our communities particularly, our ward, is our own individual expectations about what community ought to do for us. I believe we have too high an expectation about what community owes us. If we think our ward or our church or community will fulfill every aspect or of our desires, we are wrong. Not only is it not equipped to the task, in my judgment, it should not do it. It is our responsibility to build community. This is a gospel of individual salvation, not collective grace. I find my best church experiences come when I have no expectation of the church or my ward at all. I am then able to take and give unconditionally. It is my job to get in and make the church by applying my vision and inspiration without expectation. I am done. Once I am done with my vision of service, it is someone else's opportunity to apply their unique inspiration to the task. I have been amazed by how my attitudes about the church have changed when I began to see it as a vehicle by which we all learn and serve, not as a mechanism to satisfy my own individual needs. It is nice when it does, but ultimately it's my job and no one else's. In the larger sense of community, I think we can see this problem reflected in the nature of society around us. We talk about ourselves as being a litigious society. What spawns or generates a litigious society? In my judgment, a litigious society is generated because we believe whoever we perceive has harmed us owed us something, or owes us something even when they haven't harmed us. If we continue to expect community to resolve those kinds of issues, we're not ever going to be satisfied, and I think we're going to continue down the path we are on. If we are prepared to accept individual responsibility to build community on our own without the expectation that it necessarily will serve us, I think we will find in that axiom we have to lose ourselves to find ourselves. When we lose ourselves in the building of community, we will find it. If we wait for it to come to us, it will never come. A final impediment to the effective operation of the church, I believe, is how we define ourselves, or more precisely, what is the scope of the community that we believe the church is serving? Do we define ourselves as a ward by saying we help those who are LDS, who live in our small geographic area? Or do we say we will help all who live within our ward boundaries, in our state, or our town, or our country, whether they are LDS or not? The way we define ourselves or allow ourselves to be defined sends an important message and can determine how successful our efforts to build community are. Let me give an example that I actually read in the paper this morning. As I was reading the articles about the symposium, I noted that the definition of the symposium, at least by the particular writer, was a group of Mormon intellectuals. Does that mean that everybody who doesn't consider themselves an intellectual or who is not educated or who does not have a high IQ or doesn't feel comfortable in those circles is not part of this community? To many it will if we allow that definition to stand. I think of the line of Woody Allen who said, "I don't know that I'd want to join any club that would have me as a member." And I wonder then, how do we define our club? How do we define our community? Would it rather be better that we defined ourselves as a group of human beings who were seeking truth? To me, a truth-seeker definition is a lot more interesting community, a lot more diverse community, a lot more inclusive community than necessarily a group of LDS or a group of LDS intellectuals who are seeking to serve whatever end they believe is fulfilled in that regard. I believe it takes all types. I believe we have to carefully define the kind of community that we are using. Will our words be as open and effective as communities based on how we define them? Do we see our buildings as ward houses, or do we see them as community centers? We can see our priesthood as quorums and our relief society as helping members of our own LDS community, or we can see them as neighborhood organizations, as opportunities to extend what we believe and what we see to all who are around us. We can define our communities as our wards. We can define our communities any way we want them to. But it is up to us. And it is our vision, I think, in part, and in large part, that will determine whether those institutions are in fact helpful to us. But ultimately, it is us aggregated as individuals that will make the difference. Thank you.
As I have thought about the question that Albert brought to me to be on this panel, I realized I don't know that I have an adequate definition of either what community or congregation is, so you'll just have to bear with me as I use those words as if we share their meaning. I think when I hear people use the word community, I expect them to be talking about a certain level of care that includes taking responsibility for someone else and acting responsibly towards them. It's those elements that have been talked about today, including trust. I think what the element of congregation brings to this question is that of a religious community, not just any community. We belong to a number of communities. Political ones, of course, come to mind first, but professional ones. Families are communities in a way, but we're talking about congregations. What would be a religious, how do you establish that sense of responsibility and care in a religious situation? As has been mentioned, I've attended branches in the inner city now for about 8 years and had a number of responsibilities in them and have had a chance to see the church's structure operate in that kind of stripped-down way that you, like when you see race cars where they strip them down, and you see how a car works, you know, that's kind of what I feel like I've been able to watch and see whether it will work or not work and how fast it will go when you take off some of those bells and whistles. And the first branch I attended, I was quickly made the young women's leader, so I didn't attend Relief Society, but its problems were so notorious that I heard about them. And it had as its presidency a young group of women. Everybody in the branch is very young, was very young at that time, too. This is in downtown Washington, D.C. I guess I should tell you that. And we were the first branch to meet in the inner city for many years. Certainly the first branch to meet there since the revelation on the priesthood. And this Relief Society presidency fought a lot. And they couldn't lead. They could not really accomplish anything in their structure, and they were eventually released. Now, in most organizations, that would simply be a problem, an organizational problem. In a congregation, in a church, that's a sin. It's a new dimension. I mean, there was just no way for the Spirit to be in that meeting And since the Spirit couldn't be in that meeting because of the contention of the presidency, the work wasn't getting done. The work of the gospel wasn't getting done. The next young woman who was called set about ordering the Relief Society in a particular way. I was aware that Linda was very careful about having prayer meetings and having the meetings start on time and calling. She was quite rule-bound in her own way, more rule-bound than I was inclined to be. But I could see what she was leading them back into having a sense of cohesiveness by establishing their outer boundaries. And I think that sometimes we often forget that about communities. Communities are defined by their outer boundaries as much as they are by their inner cohesiveness. Communities know who they are in part by knowing who's not in the community. Sometimes we use this word community as if it means every ollie-ollie income free. But that's not the way communities work. They have addresses like neighborhoods have addresses. And they have definitions of who they are. And so I saw Linda beginning to put those boundaries in place, the outside boundaries, by calling the sisters to a certain level of accountability in their behavior, even if it was reverence during the meeting, even if it was simply coming to them. So she began to order that society, but it was still a pretty cold place. It had its outside boundaries intact, but it lacked a kind of inner cohesiveness. The sisters would come, but they would sit there. They wouldn't relate to each other. There wasn't a sense of interdependence. They were ordered. They were doing what they should do. And then I was called to be president. And I really appreciated what Linda had done. I don't know what I would have done if I had taken over in the time she took over, because truly that society was terribly damaged from the past leadership. But my challenge was a different one, and looking back on it, I can see things in a way I couldn't at the time. I now know this was a society, a community that had its external boundaries but didn't have its internal cohesiveness. And this is where I think I learned a marvelous lesson in the church. I am by default a teacher. If ever I fall back in a default position in any calling, I tend towards a kind of teacher function. But I was the Relief Society president and tried to be very respectful of my first counselor's prerogatives and her stewardship. And so I said, I only have one rule for you. I only have one thing I would ask of you. And that is, now this was, I can't take any credit for it. I think it was revelation in one of those subtle ways. I said, now I want you to make sure that whatever the lesson is, I don't care what the lesson is, and those of you who know Relief Society know that it's variously two or four different kinds of lessons, and spiritual living, I should know this, homemaking, what are the other two? Right, compassionate. So anyways, you know, I guess we're all kind of rusty on this. They all sound alike now that they're on Sunday, aren't they? Which I really didn't mind that. I think they should be spiritual living lessons every Sabbath. But I said, you can talk about whatever you want on that Sunday. And frankly, I don't even care if some of what is said is doctrinally incorrect. Because I could tell she was a little bit worried about that, because I study a little bit, and I could tell that she was concerned about whether she could get the level of learning that I might expect. And I said, no, I really frankly don't even mind if you teach a little false doctrine in there unwittingly. I don't want anybody to do it knowingly, but if you miss the mark, I'm not going to worry about that. But the only thing I'm going to ask you to do, tell your teachers and to make sure they know that the only time they'll hear from me is if that society doesn't know how they feel about Jesus Christ before they sit down. Now notice, I'm not asking you to talk about Jesus Christ. I'm asking you to say how you feel about Jesus Christ. And there's no right way to feel, so they don't have to worry about going and learning this somewhere else. But whatever that lesson is, whether it's how to do missionary work with your neighbors, or whether it's how to get the spots out of your clothes, I don't care what it is, but before you sit down, I want them to tell their sisters how they feel about Jesus Christ. And that was really the only instruction I ever gave that first counselor. I would nudge her in the direction of diversity, but I would pretty much try to keep my advice to myself. But I felt I really was concerned about that one, and that established the internal cohesiveness that made us a community, that made us a society. Those two things, I think, if I were limited, and I am by this time because I want to leave you a chance to tell your own experiences and to ask questions if you like. But those two principles, I think, guide the establishment of an LDS community. That sense of order that is based upon, I think, law and commandments as we understand it to be. Now, there's a lot I could say about that. I think wards identify themselves not unlike DNC 76 does. That there are levels of glory, that there are levels of law, and we choose what level of law we'll be governed by. And the level of law that we allow to govern us, as it says in section 88 so beautifully, protects us and perfects us. We choose the law we'll be governed by, and some of our wards, to my taste, are governed by a kind of law that's a little pharisaical, that's kind of an outward law as opposed to an internal law. But nevertheless, I think as communities we must come together, and we agree as ward communities what kind of law will govern our ward community. So communities are created, their external boundaries, they're just like a skin. Everybody's got to have a skin. It's an organ too, you know. It doesn't do much good to walk around talking about the heart if you don't have a skin. That skin is created by how we order ourselves according to the law. And wards all over the church are choosing whether it's the law of the sun, the moon, or the stars, or outer darkness, no law at all, how they're going to be ordered. That they characterize themselves as communities that way. And if you reflect on your experience in Mormon wards, you'll see how different wards have ordered themselves by different laws. But then secondly, there is this internal cohesiveness. And this is where I think a religious community is very different from any other community, particularly if that community is, as we are, Christian. I think that internal cohesiveness is created through the endowments of the Spirit, through the gift of the Holy Ghost. And that is absolutely necessary for creating that charity, that pure love of Christ that is... In any branch or ward, that sense of willingness to take a responsibility for someone else, to sacrifice for them, to sacrifice your time and your talents for the well-being of your brother and sister and to see them as individuals. So those two laws, those laws of obedience and the laws of sacrifice, I think go hand in hand in establishing a ward community. I'll end with one more story, although there are a million stories in this naked city, but there was a young man who was baptized, and the week after he was baptized, he brought his mother and his younger brother with him to church, and you could tell this young man, he was in his early 20s, maybe late teens, but was converted. Now, not everybody keeps that level of light, but you could see that this young man had the power of the Spirit in him, and he was anxious to share that with his family. So he brought his mother and his brother with him, and his brother loved it, went to primary and said he wanted to go the rest of his life, and the mother was very interested. And the next week, this young man was murdered. This happened about 5 years ago. It's still hard to talk about. Now, he went to see his child, his girlfriend and his child, and he was murdered while he was making that visit. And these are very troubled relationships. And so here we had a funeral. Now, few things test a ward or a branch more than a funeral, I think. And this young man had been in our midst maybe 2 weeks. But this sense of bonding with him was very real for us. Because he loved what we loved, and we loved each other in loving the gospel. Well, the funeral was held at a mortuary because we didn't have a chapel, and of course he was a rather new member, and the family was, and of course we understood that, but we wanted to attend, and we did, and it was a classic Southern funeral. Lots of people, open casket, and three ministers. They had two Baptist ministers and a Mormon minister. They invited our branch president, Carl, to speak. And I remember being worried for Carl because for all his strengths, and they were manifest, he wasn't really a good speaker. And I knew that he was with a couple of fellows here who did this for a living and were very good at it. They were Baptist preachers. And so the first one got up and gave a gorgeous sermon out of 1 Corinthians 15 and talked about the resurrection of the dead and really warmed up the house. And the second one got up and did the same. And then it was Carl, who's a slender young man anyway in his suit, and he gets up and he starts to talk, as we do in our tradition. We don't preach, we talk, and we kind of pride ourselves on that. But it sounds very different. And if you're in a tradition where people preach, that kind of rhetorical style is very different. And Carl just got up and started to talk. Now, they had introduced him as a minister of his congregation, and everybody was listening, and he started to talk about what he knew about this young man. And he said, I didn't know Brian very well. I only met him 3 weeks ago when I interviewed, and he started to tell the story of how he knew him. Well, he got about five sentences into this, and he stopped talking, and he just looked at the floor. Now, I knew Carl was crying, because Carl was famous for this. He just had the tenderest heart in the world. He was really a Christian man. And as he reflected on how he knew this young man, he started to weep. And I remember in that silence, people began to realize that he had started to cry. And I heard a voice say, "Amen, amen." And then another voice from over on the other side said, "That's all right now, that's all right." Cohesiveness began to build in that room. And the spirit was very much there with Carl, but it was there because of the love he had and the love he offered, and that evoked the love in that congregation, in that disparate community. Now, Carl gave a very bad talk, I tell you that. I mean, he just doesn't know. He didn't teach much doctrine. But what he demonstrated in his life, in the love he had, and his testimony of Jesus Christ was sufficient for that occasion, more than sufficient. And what I want to say about that is section, I believe it's 45, that gives the law of the church says, "Thou shalt live together in love, and so much that thou shalt mourn with those that die." There was an honesty and integrity and a charity there in Carl's response that was undeniable. I think that's what makes community. I think it's that combination of ordering your life, and it's that and everyone that you are going to church with agreeing at some level, whatever that law is that your congregation will admit to, and it will vary, agreeing to order your life about what's important, and then it's inviting the Spirit into your life. We are told in the Book of Mormon that the Lord gives this gift of charity to those who diligently serve him. And that is what I believe makes a Christian community, makes a good Latter-day Saint community. And I have seen it bind people of remarkably disparate backgrounds and skill levels. I have seen branches where it hasn't been there. I've seen it where it's there, and I think that where it's been lacking, it's because they've lacked that commitment to obedience, to obey the law of the God, whatever that law is, whatever that standard is they've held out for themselves. And where they have not humbled themselves and submitted themselves and their lives to Jesus Christ in such a manner that they've invited him to be a part of their everyday worship activities. I think that's what makes the community that I like to go to church in. So thank you.
I'd like to thank you all three panelists for your examples and your perspective, and makes me think more about what I want out of my congregation as a community. And we have about roughly 5 minutes for questions from the audience, and I'm going to move this over here so you don't have to stand up. Does anyone have a question? Right here in the front row.
I think it's the particular characteristic of God's economy that you don't have to choose, in some respects, where the benefit lies. Everybody benefits. But absolutely, I think that the personal order is foundational to the community, or the community is comprised of the personal commitments to obedience and the personal commitments to sacrifice, as illustrated in the life of Christ. So, yeah, the individuals have to make those covenant promises and keep them before the community can do it.
That's how I see it. I just think that if you look in the totality of the questions he asked and the evolution of his life from the time he posed those questions, that he clearly felt things were lacking. If he hadn't, he wouldn't have been, I think, impressed to ask the initial question at that time in the burned-over district in New York about what was the true religion. I think if he had not been impressed about the nature of the economic aspects, that he wouldn't have founded the banks and done everything that he did in Kirtland, even though he ended up failing. I think he wouldn't have asked the questions about polygamy. I don't think he would have asked those questions if he would have been satisfied that the nature of community was adequate to meet the needs of the people. And I think he had a vision, or at least, if not a vision, an instinct, that there was a new and more glorious way of accomplishing those, and that as he learned line upon line, precept upon precept, that the spirit and the essence of Jesus Christ at the center, as Kathleen has pointed out, would and could evolve into not only intimate communities in our families, but large communities where we could grow and prosper. That's my sense of what he was about. That's, in fact, that's, I think, one of his most attractive characteristics, personally. Well, I'll respond first. One of the points I was trying to make about economy was that we no longer share things as individuals with one another. We can, but our lives are so disparate. We're pushed in so many different directions. There's so many pushes and pulls that there really is no opportunity to share some of the very basic things. My suggestion is in those communities or in those churches is that you try to find some things, and that you may have to reach out. If you expect that the community will be offered to you, sometimes it doesn't come. That you have to reach out and find some things that you can do and share, whether it's teaching the gospel or a spiritual experience, whether it's cleaning a ditch. It's something. We need to connect at some basic and essential level. And I think we've got to take the responsibility, if we want it, of going out and trying to find and figure out how to practice. If you have the luxury of being in a church position, then maybe you can organize your particular area so that you can reach others in that particular way. Otherwise, I think you may have to go and help. But what you do, you can create on your own. And community can be, I think, fundamental in that way.
If I could just respond, too. Maybe I just haven't experienced it yet, but my experience in the church is that it doesn't happen so automatically. I was listening, and I was moved by Kathleen's remarks, and I certainly agree this commitment to Christ is critical to who we are and to our church experience. But I've been in wards where I felt my commitment to Christ was there, and I even felt that my bishop had a commitment to Christ, and there were other people who... But to me, that was still not a ward community. We still didn't sense that we were doing it together. And I tend to have a negative view about being pushed around and led around, and I'm not a person who is particularly prone to elevate the principle of obedience or followership very often. But as I thought about this assignment about community building in a ward, and I just assumed, you know, a ward was sort of the assumption that I was looking at how to build ward sense of community in a ward. My experience is that it depends a lot on the determination of the designated leaders to be willing to do something very intentional, to really want to make that commitment to Christ and the other goals that are part of the Christian and Mormon community something that everybody in the whole ward can feel a part of. And so for me, if I'm in the same, and I have been in the same position that you've described yourself, and it doesn't always work, but what I've tried to do and what I would continue to do given the sweetness of this recent experience is that I would go to the bishop and the Relief Society president and to the Bishop Rick and ask for more and ask for their commitment to involve everyone and to try to work with them to push them to invite each person's talents and gifts into that process. And I think, unfortunately, that it takes some kinds of skills which everyone doesn't have. And I don't think that the ward experience is necessarily a total failure if you don't have that, but I think it's so sweet when everyone can be a part of it. And all I am learning is that it's often the result of the testimony and the commitment to the Savior, which are basic and important, but also some real intentionality to making it clear that the ward belongs to every person who's on the membership rolls, and that you don't have to be in the bishopric or you don't have to be a person who's been there a long time. You could have just joined this month. And you and I was in a session yesterday where someone was saying, well, do we have a trained clergy? And I don't believe that we should. I mean, that would be a great loss to us. We've done a lot of things right that have sort of evolved with inspiration, where we have people who are called from many walks of life. But I do think it's worth teaching one another when we have that awareness that sometimes that intention to reach out and to make it clear that you value each person's participation in that ward process is a part of leadership that every ward in the whole church could benefit from, whether they're in Nigeria or St. Petersburg or Taiwan or Salt Lake. And so there, I think there are some skills that could be universalized, and I don't think they only come with inspiration. I think sometimes you have to really work at them.
Okay, we're out of time. I'm sorry. But I'm sure if you have questions, you can come up and ask them. But thank you for coming, and enjoy the rest of the symposium.